Thank you very much, Kim. You hear me in the back okay? All right, very good. And you did a great job of pronouncing my name right. Not everybody can do that. My wife, she kept my name for 3 weeks and gave it back to me. She thought Kyle was a lot easier, and I don't blame her. We're going to talk about fearful behavior in companion animals today. And the majority of my caseload, the pets that are presented to me have problems that are related to fear. And they involve anxiety disorders, phobias, and fear-related aggression. And by and far, the biggest part of my caseload. And in some cases, like fear-related aggressive behavior, these are problems that can be prevented if we spend the time during vaccination visits talking to pet owners about socialization and handling exercises and so forth. What we're going to do this morning is we're going to talk a little bit about fear in general. We'll look at some specific problems. We're going to talk about the general approach with using behavior modification, as well as options for pharmacologic intervention. Okay, so let's look at some definitions here. First of all, anxiety. Anxiety is an apprehensive anticipation of future danger or misfortune accompanied by a feeling of dysphoria. So there's not a stimulus present that the animal's afraid of, but there's just general feeling that something bad might happen. So with this are associated certain somatic signs. We'll see hypervigilance, scanning behavior, and increase in autonomic activity, increased heart rate, respiratory rate. We might see hypersalivation and dilated pupils, too. We also might see some increased motor activity, tension, stress vocalizations, displacement behaviors, pacing behavior might be associated with this. And I want to show you this video on displacement behaviors. This is from a really nice tape on animal behavior for veterinary staff and shelter by Dan Estep and Suzanne Hetz. They're a PhD behaviorist in the Denver area and have a really good solid behavior practice here for those of you in this area. And displacement behaviors are normal behaviors that occur out of context. Typically they occur in conflict or stress situations, and they occur yawning, lip licking, grooming behaviors. Say, in people, you might be straightening your tie over and over again before you go out and speak or doing something like this. You know, those would be displacement behaviors that signal you're not quite comfortable about something. And those are important signals to recognize in our pets. For you all that are just coming in now, in room 208, if you want a seat in room 208, what? They sent you down here? Child daycare.
I gotta wait for my kids for
this. Welcome back in that case. Oh boy. Okay, so it's important to understand displacement behaviors, because if you're doing behavior modification, you're going to start at a level where the pet's not anxious and gradually make positive associations with stronger stimuli. And if you see that the pet's showing displacement behaviors, that's a sign that maybe you're pushing the treatment a little bit too quickly. And in cats, we see displacement behaviors too. And this cat is approached. It's a fearful cat in the corner. And you'll see some lip licking here. And a little bit closer, and the cat becomes aggressive. Okay. Fear, on the other hand, is a feeling of apprehension associated with a presence or proximity of a specific stimulus. And this might be an object, a noise, an individual, or possibly a social situation. Fear is not bad in itself. Fear can be an important adaptive response. The appropriateness of the fear response, though, is determined by the context in which it occurs. And so you have normal fear responses, and it's normal for this cat to be a little uptight about being shoved in the face of this dog, and that's an appropriate fear response for a small animal in the presence of a large animal or possible predator. An abnormal fear response, though, is one that occurs in out of context of real danger. There's no real danger here, or is excessive for the needs of the situation. If that gazelle sees a lion 100 yards away and just becomes so panicked that it doesn't think about anything except escaping, and it runs off into a ravine and dies from the fall, then that's excessive for the needs of the situation, and it becomes detrimental to the well-being of the animal. Phobias are more intense fear responses. They're profound, very excessive, abnormal fear responses manifested by extreme behaviors. And so you might see in people, they describe hysteria, panic, catatonia. An example in a dog, that perhaps has a phobia that involves thunderstorms. These animals have a hyper response. They're going through doors or breaking windows. They're injuring themselves or enduring pain during these phobic attacks. They can be typically acquired or learned. The animals pick these up during the course of their lives. They're irrational. They're not adaptive to the animal. And they tend to persist. They become very deeply ingrained with the animal, and they can be a real challenge to treat sometimes. So anxiety, fear, or phobic disorders that we see are abnormal or exaggerated manifestations of arousal. The animals have a problem with response control. They go from 0 to 100, and they have no pretty much out of control on really what they're doing, especially with the phobic responses. Why do they occur? Well, there can be some genetic predispositions in some animals. But oftentimes these are molded by certain life experiences, and maybe traumatic experiences or lack of experience, like lack of socialization. All right, so let's look at how we treat fear problems in a pet. We can do things to the environment to make the pet more comfortable. We can avoid exposure to things that makes the pet anxious. During a storm, we could confine the pet to a soundproof room in the basement. Not always real practical. We could modify the stimulus for fear. So if the pet's afraid of people, we can have them come over and ignore the pet, or maybe be sitting before the pet's brought into the room. So we can have the people change so they're less likely to elicit a fear response. But ideally, we want to modify the pet's response. And so we could do that through behavior modification, very important. Pheromones can be very helpful, or medication and with some of the more severe problems. And so there are a variety of types of behavior modification tools we might think about using. Extinction involves taking away the reinforcement for a behavior, so it decreases in frequency. Flooding involves taking the full force of the stimulus and exposing the animal to it for a duration of time until the animal's response disappears. Habituation involves repeated exposure to the fear-eliciting stimulus until the animal habituates to or does not show a response. The two that are used most commonly, though, or desensitization and counterconditioning. Desensitization is similar to habituation in that you have repeated exposure to the stimulus that elicits the fear response, but you start under the threshold so the animal's not anxious. And so if the animal is afraid of people or a man at 20 feet, then what we might do is have a man pass through the room or come around the corner of the backyard at 25 or 30 feet so the animal orients, recognizes it's a man, but it's not strong enough or not close enough to elicit a fear response. And then we can do counterconditioning, which is reinforced an alternative, incompatible physiologic and behavioral response to the stimulus by simply giving the dog a treat. So that men coming into the backyard are no longer a trigger for fear, but they actually become a cue that something good is going to happen. Punishment is typically counterindicated. If you have any kind of problem, whether it might be whether it's separation anxiety or the dog's destructive during thunderstorm problems, or whether it's fear-related aggression, punishment typically is going to make things worse. So you usually want to avoid anything aversive while you're training. All right, let's look at the fear response. We want to talk about a few specifics here that are important. When we're talking about fear response, we have a subject. We have a stimulus, an unfamiliar man, a strange man in this case, within a certain threshold, you know, typically we're talking about distance, we're talking about a fear of people, but it could be a volume threshold when we're talking about storms or noise phobias, that within a threshold we see the fearful response will be elicited. And so let's say our threshold's 10 feet, so any man that approaches the dog within 10 feet is going to make the dog anxious. And then any man that stays beyond 10 feet, the dog is going to be relaxed. So it's important to understand thresholds, because you always want to start outside the threshold so the animal doesn't have any anxiety during the retraining process. So if we look at desensitization again, desensitization, as I mentioned, involves repeated exposure starting outside the threshold. So this is healthier mentally for the pet to not endure an anxious response, but if you're dealing with fear-related aggression, it's also safer for the people in the dog's environment. So we'll have a man walk, let's say, maybe 15 feet away through the room, and just back and forth, and gradually we'll find that the threshold gets closer and closer to the dog, where the man can walk 10 feet away, and 8 and 6, until a man can stand right next to the pet. But it's done so slow that we see no anxiety from the subject. Now, if we want to add counter-conditioning to this, and this is typically what we do, we'll have the repeated exposures again, starting beyond the threshold, But each time the man passes through the dog's line of vision, what we're going to do is make a positive association. And typically we'll use food. It's a nice discrete stimulus. Most dogs like food. Although there are some dogs, like maybe border collies, we might use a little short fetch session or show the dog a retrieving toy or a ball or something like that. Other dogs, maybe social attention is more important to the pet than food. So you have to do reinforcer assessment to find out what is the most valuable reinforcer for the pet. All right, we just keep repeating, gradually getting closer and closer, and gradually we see that threshold going closer and closer towards the subject animal. So for virtually all types of fearful problems where we have a pet that's going to be afraid of noise or people or visual objects, these are the steps you're going to go through. You're going to identify the fear-eliciting stimulus. You're going to identify the threshold. How close does it have to be, or how loud does it have to be, or how big does it have to be to elicit the fear response? So we can start beyond that threshold, and we're going to range our gradient of stimuli for least offensive to most offensive, the problem situation. And we're going to do desensitization and counter-conditioning. Other considerations, I alluded to this earlier, we want to avoid aversives. We want to be careful that we don't reinforce fear-related behaviors. It's not likely that you can actually reinforce the emotion of fear, but you can reinforce behaviors related to that. And if you have a little German Shepherd puppy that's 4 months old, and when somebody approaches the owner, it gets behind the owner, peeks around and growls, if the owner pets it, it's probably not going to reinforce fear, but it'll reinforce that growling behavior. And we want to avoid uncontrolled exposure to fear-eliciting stimuli. So every time the animal is exposed to maybe men in this situation we discussed, and the animal has a panic attack, then the problem, we're going to lose a little bit. We're going to take a step backward. So we want to control the pet's environment so it has no adverse experiences around whatever we're counter-conditioning it towards. And as I mentioned, go so slow that no anxiety is elicited. So it takes patience to work with these pets, more so with cats and dogs. And so many people will recognize that, especially with pets that are afraid of people, they need to be socialized and learn that people are okay, but they go too fast about it, especially people who have good hearts, but they're rescuing dogs and cats, and so they take the dog or the cat to the mall, or they stick the cat in the dog's face to try to teach, oh, Fluffy's good, and the animal's going, oh, this is way too much, way too quick. And so we don't want to flood it. Flooding can work in certain situations, but exposing the animal to the full exposure of a strong stimulus can actually make things a lot worse. Just like that'd be akin to a person being afraid of spiders, and you tie into a chair and you put a tarantula in their lap. No matter how long that tarantula is there, they're not going to get better. They'll probably get worse. I saw Jewel a few years back, a six-month-old intact female. She grew up in a home with a breeder, and the dog was in a run most of the time. Occasionally we get out and interact with the dogs in the yard. Lady lived by herself, very little social contact with people, rural environment, very little urban or in noise and sound experience other than this quiet little rural area. And so the people adopted this dog, and she was just shy and afraid of things. She'd walk along the street and saw a newspaper. She'd jump back. A flag rattled. She'd get really nervous about it, want to pull the owner across the street. Very skitty, startled easily. She was afraid of her reflection in the stereo case. If she went into the family room and happened to glance over there and see herself, she'd go, oh, my God, who is that, and run out of the room. And so she was afraid of garbage cans. And what we did for the reflection, that was a little bit of a challenge because we couldn't set up a situation where we had enough distance in a house to use distance as a variable. And so we used the size of the reflection, and we simply covered the glass panel and only exposed about an inch and a half. So the animal walked by, could just kind of barely see a little flicker of itself, but not enough to make it anxious. Every time it glanced at that little flicker, it was given a treat and gradually removed the towels, and the pet was real comfortable with that. Molly, this was an interesting case, little schnauzer cross, and the owner complained of acute panic episodes, and this is after she'd moved from a small home into a duplex. And the dog would suddenly startle and run. It was trembling during these episodes. It was doing some hypervigilant behavior and scanning. She only saw this behavior at home, and it had been going on for a couple months. That's when she had moved. And So the question was, you know, the dog wasn't, you know, why was this dog just having, why was it just start having these 2 months ago, only had them at home? Was there something in the environment that was triggering these? And so we talked, had a consultation, we talked about things, and she went back home, and I said, just watch a little bit closer, keep a diary. And what she found out is in the duplex, she had a hot water heater in a closet in the kitchen. And when it went on, the pipes would creak and crack a little bit, and she had kind of tuned that out, but the dog was really tuned into that, and when that came on, that's what triggered the panic attacks. And so we muffled those sounds, and we did a little bit of simple desensitization and counter-conditioning and took care of that problem. If you have unusual problems that pop up that occur inconsistently, and there doesn't seem to be a specific trigger, sometimes you think about epilepsy, you know, causing something to occur just real spontaneously, but that diary can be really helpful in helping the owner get a little bit better look at the situation and ferret out these important stimuli in these cases. All right, so if we have a dog that's afraid of men, we're going to have a gradient from less fearful to more fearful. So if we want to start having people come in and greet the dog, we might just start having familiar women come over and having the dog sit for treats or have the owner give it treats, and then we progress unfamiliar women, familiar boys, familiar men, unfamiliar men, and go through a gradient like that. So we start out with something really easy. It's not going to make the dog anxious. So it's looking forward to having people come through the front door and getting treats, and we go to more difficult situations. With fear-related aggression problems, we'll talk a little bit in detail about this because this is a common situation, common type of problem we deal with. The animal wants to get away, but it can't. And so it'll, yes?
When you're doing the fear gradients with the men,
Is the dog on the leash? You want the situation to be safe. And so every situation is a little bit different. And with fear-related aggression, usually the animal doesn't want to interact. It stays at a distance and acts aggressive. And so you don't always have to use a leash. But probably majority of times I'll recommend that just to make sure that we have complete control of the pet. Yeah. There are other cases we might think about using a muzzle or a gentle leader or a head halter and a leash, but certainly you have to evaluate the situation when you're working with aggression and make sure that there is complete control of that pet and there's no chance for an injury. All right, so we see some threat behavior. If the animal is unable to escape, the threatening stimulus doesn't move away, and then we may see aggressive behavior. The probability of bite is going to depend on variables about the pet. It's going to depend on its threshold becoming fearful. It's also going to depend on its past history and whether aggression has been successful in removing the stimulus. So if you have a cat that on a couch when a child approaches, if it hisses and growls, the child backs up and goes away, then the animal learns this is a successful strategy in keeping distance between me and what makes me afraid. And so if the animal's had a history of using aggression successfully, then that'll increase the possibility of a bite if it's really pushed. And then environmental variables would include the quality of the fearful stimuli, the number, the intensity, and very importantly, whether or not the animal has an avenue for escape. This little Cocker Spaniel was not socialized to children, had no contact with children at all during the first year of life, and the complaint was that it growled at children, and also that it barks and occasionally urinates when approached, and has bitten 3 times and broken the skin once. And so what does this tell you? Well, if the dog urinates when approached during the aggression, well, it's probably, you know, fear-related, and it certainly was. The other big thing here is the dog's bitten 3 times. Why did the owner let it bite more than 1 time? The owner realized the dog needed to be socialized, and so what she would do is she would kind of keep an eye out in the backyard because kids would cut through the backyard, and whenever a child would cut through the backyard, she would take the dog out by the collar and hold it so it could learn about kids and ask the kids to pet the dog on the head. And so a really dire example of people trying to make dogs feel more comfortable too quickly, making the situation worse. We talk about social signaling in This Is Wolves. This is from Roger Abrantes' book, real nice book on wolf behavior. We have submissive signaling, sometimes called appeasement behavior, and dominant or assertive signaling. And we talk about fear-related aggression problems. We see ambivalent behavior. We see some essence of both type. And so with submissive signaling, you see the ears down, and you see the body lowered, the tail tucked, and the commissure's lips pulled back horizontally. And with the dominant signaling, you see the ears forward and the animal leaning in, and the commissures actually pulled forward when you get this aggressive pucker like this. And and then you see you have aggressive growling. With fear-related aggression, we have some of the elements of both. While we have the ears down and the body lowered and the tail tucked, we still have some growling. We have some teeth exposed, exposed in a different way, though, a little subtle difference. It differentiates fear-related aggression and more assertive aggressive animal. Look at those commissures. And we might see some hackles up, but the animal's leaning backwards. So we got a dog that's growling, exposing teeth, but its ears are down, its tail's down. We're seeing ambivalent behavior. When you see behaviors that are mixed like that, that tells you the animal's in conflict. Here's an example. This is in the off-leash park in Shawnee Mission, Kansas. And we have the dog on the left, the assertive dog, approaching. And the dog on the right lowers its rear end, its tail down. You can't read its hair. You can't read its ears. That's a problem with some of our breeds, is they've lost the ability to communicate real well. And those are sort of submissive behaviors. But he starts growling and he's staring. That's a more assertive behavior. So we're seeing ambivalent behaviors. These behaviors are mixed. The dog on the left took a step forward, and our little dog on the right turned tail and took off. Here is a photo from in a veterinary hospital, and we have a technician coming up, and this little mastiff puppy is about 4 months old, and it's afraid, it's backing up. The technician's trying to say, "Hey, I like puppies," and it's trying leaning a hand out to sniff, and that puppy's growling, and so the technician is doing everything opposite of what they should do, what she should do, and most people do this when they want to, the same thing when they want to greet a fearful pet. But we have a lot going on here. She's crowding this dog. She's big. She's over the top of the pet. She has that hand coming down. We think, okay, this is like an appeasement gesture. I'm okay. The animal sees it as a threat. Very importantly, she's making strong eye contact. Eye contact is really, really important. And oftentimes, with these fearful animals, if people come over to the home and just avoid eye contact with the dog, the speed at which they start warming up is significantly increased. And the dog is crowded against the wall, so we've removed an avenue for escape. And what happens when he growls? The owner gets nervous and, it flips out. The owner gets nervous and ties up on the lead. So now we've really got this frightened dog scared. It's frozen, can't get away, and we have this big monster coming up and saying, "I love puppies, but looking like I might take your head off." So anyway. Oh, this is a really neat device. This is a quick release lead. Has anybody ever seen one of these? Maybe one of my other lectures? This is... You have these dogs that come in the hospital, and they come in the reception area, and the receptionist puts a leash, one of the slip leashes on the dog, and it's kind of a nervous dog, but it's not acting too bad. You take it back, and you put it in the cage, and you go to take it off, and the dog turns into Cujo, like that. And so you get a broomstick or a hanger, and you're doing one of these stuff, and these dogs are like that. And this leash here turns into a figure eight leash, will solve that problem. And what we have here is 10 feet. We used to make these. You can buy these now. I'll mention that in a moment. You got a 10 feet of nylon ski rope. And we tie it together. You can sew it together, tape it like that so it interlocks. And we're going to grab one end about 6 or 8 inches away from the loop. And we're going to tuck it in, the loop on the other side, and pull it through. And it turns it into a figure eight. And when it turns into a figure eight like that, you slip it on the pet's head, over the pet's head. And when you pull on one end of it, it tightens it up, just like a regular slip lead, and you put it on the other end, and it pulls it off the dog's head. And it's really, really cool. And there are two products out there now. Premier Pets has a product like this, Campbell Pet Company has a similar product too. But both of them, I don't remember what the names of those are. I think both of them probably have booths here. You can stop by and take a look. But they're really, really helpful for those type of problems. Okay, Chance was a 6-year-old poodle that I saw, and you can just kind of look at him right here. He's not the most confident dog in the world. Fearful, growls and snaps at the child in the home, leaves the room whenever the child enters. That's a red flag. And some people say, well, it's great that the dog's had enough. He just kind of avoids the child. But that tells me the dog's uncomfortable. We need to work on teaching the dog to be more comfortable with the child. And the reason the dog was so uncomfortable around the child, this little kid was bouncing off the walls. And so I said, "Here, play with this." And I turned around, and I heard this crunching noise. And he bit the nose off my gentle leader dog. So I said, let's talk about parenting for a while. So head halters are really great devices, and the reason I just want to mention this, I'm sure you all are familiar with head halters, but especially the Gentileader and Halty, those have been out for a long time. All of you may not be familiar with the Snoot Loop by Peter Borschelt. He's a behaviorist in New York. He's been around for a long time. That doesn't sound too good for Peter, but he's been one of the pioneers in the behavior field. His device is similar, except it has a sidebar with a buckle on it. And so with this, with his, you can. It's a little bit more complicated to fit than the other, so I don't recommend it all the time. But if you have a brachycephalic breed, you can really tighten it up. And for some dogs that you can't get a Gentileader or a Halty on, that works real nice. And if you, I have a place on my website, which is westwoodanimalhospital.com. If you go to the behavior information area, I've got about 6 pages of resources. I've got one page that has all the products that I'll mention throughout the day. I've got videos and books and pamphlets and all types of things there. So westwoodanimalhospital.com. I also have a number of behavior articles, too, you might be interested in. All right. So what safe things can we recommend to the owner that has a fearful pet when visitors come over? First thing I recommend is a delayed greeting. Instead of having the pet in the foyer area when that person invades the front door and gets the dog all revved up, just put the dog someplace else before people come over. So put it in a distant room of the house, turn the radio up so it can't hear the person coming in, give it some toys that are stuffed full of meat and cheese and really special stuff. So that even if it can hear the person coming in, hopefully it'll be distracted and it has a positive association with somebody coming in. We're going to do a delayed greeting. Pets confined to a room, radio to mask the noise. Then we're going to have the visitor quietly enter the home. And we're going to have a person sit down at a couch in the far end of a large room. We're going to give the person something really special. Not just biscuit treats, but it's going to be little chunks of chicken or turkey or freeze-dried liver, whatever has a high food value for the pet. Visitor's instructions will be to speak quietly once a pet comes in, move very little, no eye contact, and just pretty much ignore the pet initially. So after a short visit, the owner's going to go to the confinement area to get the pet. And what we'll do is have the pet sit, give it a treat, and then put the head halter on if necessary. If it's a less reactive dog, less likely to bark and growl, more likely just to be anxious, maybe just a flat collar be appropriate. But we'll have a leash on the pet. And then we'll have the dog do a sit-stay, just a short little sit-stay treat, about every 3 to 5 feet as we go down the hallway to meet the person in the room. Okay? So we're kind of priming the pump. As we come down the hallway, we're saying, sit, I'm in control of this situation, treat, this is going to be a good situation. So the animal is coming down the hallway and starting to focus on the owner and expect treats and hopefully is relaxed when it comes in. As soon as the pet comes into the room and sees that person, the second it sees that person, the owner is going to go Rover and put a treat in front of its nose. So we want that dog's attention right away. Rover, treat, and then sit and stay. Good dog, give it a treat. Walk over towards the a chair across the room from the person, another sit for a treat, and then the owner's going to ignore the pet, and then the visitor is going to start flipping treats. Not going to look, not going to toss, just casually flip treats. So treats start raining out of the sky. So the dogs go, whoa, this is pretty good, having people over in the house. Food falls out of the sky when this happens. And then for a dog that's real fearful, maybe that's all you'll do during the visit. You'll do that for a half hour or so and then maybe put the pet back up. If the pet's not quite so anxious, then during that visit or subsequent visits, then the next thing you do is flip the treats so they land closer and closer to the person that's ignoring the dog. And then if we're doing real well, the next step would be to let the pet take the treat out of the hand. Then once we're doing real well with that and everybody's relaxed, the dog's not showing any displacement behaviors or hypervigilance, then the next step is going to be to ask the dog to sit for treat and gradually start making eye contact as we have the dog sit for treats. And then gradually, depending on the comfort level and so forth, we'll gradually allow freedom in the home. And then we can do that in stages. The first thing we can do is drop the end of the leash and let the dog wander around with the leash attached to a flat collar or to a head halter. So if something happens, the animal starts stressing out, we don't have to run over there and grab it or something or grab its collar. We have a little bit of a remote handle we can get on the pet. The next step would be the first step would be to wear the head halter if we're going to do that. Second would be wear a flat collar. And the third would be to allow the dog free without a leash in the home. And at that point, we might, depending on the dog's reactivity, past history, size of the pet maybe, we might think about a muzzle at that point. Once the pet seems to be relaxed, maybe, yes? Yeah. the question is, how often should you do this? And I guess time framing mean how soon should you expect to see results? And you kind of answered your own question. Every case is different. And if the dog is, as far as how often you should do it, gosh, if you could do it twice a day, it would be excellent. Some people, maybe they're new in the neighborhood, they may not have somebody that can come over but once a month. And there are other things they can do on walks that we'll talk about here in a moment. The more they can do it, the faster things are going to go. And if you have somebody that has a lot of people, that have a lot of people can come over, and they can control exposure so the animal never endures any kind of fear response, you can make significant changes within 3 to 4 weeks. Other animals, it could be 6 to 12 months. You know, with they have severe fear responses, they had inadequate socialization and so forth. Yes. Good question. What if you see some fear? I just interrupt the behavior and then refocus the animal on something else. So if the animal hesitates, maybe hesitates and even growls just a little bit, you don't want to say, oh, honey, that's George, you know him, please be good, because you might reinforce that growling, but you don't want to punish the dog either. And so typically I will, hey, what's that? You know, it's anything to make the dog orient towards me. So just a little sharp something to make the dog orient, and I'll say, hey, come on over here, and then I might either just bail out of the situation, or maybe I'll give it a Kong toy stuffed with food and put it at the far end of the room, let it focus on something else for a while. Maybe I'll practice some obedience with treats. But just interrupt the behavior and then redirect or refocus the dog on something else, or possibly get it out of the situation. Now, once the dog's comfortable with somebody that's been coming over, we got a lot to go through. I'm going to try to wait for questions till the end, or else we're not going to get through everything. Once the dog is comfortable maybe with a certain person that's visited a number of times, then my rule that'll stay in place indefinitely is nobody ever pets the dog unless it sits for a treat first. And your reason you do that is that it reminds the dog that the visitor's in charge, the visitor's a good guy, and you're also less likely to be overconfident and touch the dog that's not facing you, startle it, and have a bite. Certainly want to avoid harsh corrections, stay calm, avoid loud noises and agitation. The owner gets real excited about things is going to cause the dog to be more anxious. And we want to avoid what I call preemptive scoldings. The tendency is, if there's a visitor sitting here and the dog is kind of easing up there and all of a sudden kind of gets a funny look and maybe lifts his lip a little bit, hasn't done anything really bad, often owners will go, leave it, don't you do that, you get away from that guy or something like that. And what they do is make the dog more nervous. And to avoid that, I have the owners work on a really good recall where they can say the dog's name and it looks, and they go, come, and use a hand signal and the dog runs right up. That way, then, if they have a situation, whether it's with the visitor or maybe a situation where the dog's nervous about how the owner's nervous about how the dog's interacting with a child, then they can go, Rover, come, and they can make the situation safe on an upbeat note rather than adding more tension, which could even trigger an attack. All right, we can also engage the dog in games, possibly, that might be something pleasant with the visitor, so fetch. Monkey in the Middle is a game I really encourage people to do. And this is a game that I have pet owners play with puppies to teach them the come on command. And what it involves is having the puppy run between people and sit for really cool, really good treats. So you say the dog's name, use your hand signal, call the dog over and have it sit. And so the family does this with the dog. So the dog learns this game where when people sit down in the living room with a handful of food, it runs back and forth and gets something good. And for puppies, it's great. It teaches its name. It teaches it to orient when it hears its name, which is the first step in getting the puppy to do anything. It teaches the dog to run up and have a hand come out, but something good happened. And it teaches the dog to run up and sit instead of jump up on people. So it's a great game. And then what you do is you have the visitor come over and you get the visitor engaged in the game too. Dennis used to be my puppy class trainer. He has that puppy class trainer voice. We also want to curb all territorial displays. And these dogs that are fearful very often get into territorial aggression because they sit at the windows of the fence line and somebody goes by and they go, whoa, whoa. And what happens? The person goes away. And the dog says, if I kind of have this bold, aggressive type vocalization, people leave. And typically that gets shaped until you have these dogs that start out as fearful dogs and they're lunging and tearing down drapes and bouncing off the windows and things like that. And this is the case. This dog, border collie mix, barks and backs up when people enter. So it acts aggressive, but it backs up, so it's fearful. Outdoors most of the day, busy neighborhood, the corner lot, sidewalk on both sides of the yard, viciously lunging at passersby, and aggression accelerated 6 months ago. And this is after the family moved from a quiet neighborhood to this neighborhood. So this guy would sit out there, and every time somebody walked by, it was bouncing off the fence. Now you came in, the dog would bark and back up. But we want to make sure that the dog's environment is controlled, so it's not sitting in the window all day or not in the backyard all day acting aggressive, and we're losing ground as we're trying to modify the aggressive behavior. Now, this is nice, some nice safe stuff that you can recommend for people to do on a walk. You want to have them walk in relatively quiet areas. Use a head halter if necessary if the dog's really reactive. And we're going to do desensitization and counter conditioning. And what you do is you're going to tell the owner to watch, to as you walk along, watch for other people. And as soon as the owner sees a person, what they're going to do is glance down and watch the dog's behavior. Because the dog will be sniffing along. And at some point, the dog's going to look up and cock its head, maybe say, oh, I think that's a person two blocks away. And the second that the dog does that, we're going to do like we talked about in the living room. Right away, immediately, we're going to go Rover and put a treat in front of that dog's nose. So something good happens right away when it sees somebody at a distance. Have it sit, stay, good dog, and give it a treat. And then if it is at quite a distance, like two blocks, and let's say our threshold distance, thresholds are important again, is maybe 50 feet, then what we'll do is maybe continue walking, and after another 20 or 25 feet, the dog will be looking around and looks at that person again, sit for a treat. And continue doing that until we get to about maybe 70 feet. And then we're going to turn around and go the other direction. And we're going to look for somebody else. And we're going to do sit stays until we get to 70 feet. And then gradually you get to 60 feet and 55. You gradually be able to get closer and closer. And the dog's learning to look forward to seeing people. Hopefully this dog at some point will be sitting around the living room and, man, I hope he gets home from work pretty soon. I hope I go out and see a lot of people I don't know because I get something good every time. And I never get, you know, close enough where anybody does anything that makes me upset. And another place that they can do these is... they can use walking trails and parking lots to work on things like that. Make sure we got a secure dog that's not going to run off and attack anybody. Usually that's not the case with a fearful dog. But you can take a jogging trail, we can get beyond our threshold distance at about 60 or 70 feet, and just hang out with chunks of chicken. And every time somebody comes around the corner or over the hill or around the side of a building and the dog orients, you simply have it sit for a treat. Real simple, safe things that the owner can confidently doing without putting anybody in any danger. Now, if you're doing real well, you will get to a point where the person can get within 4 or 5 feet of somebody, and if it's a cute dog, people are going to want to pet that dog, and you don't want that to happen. I don't, with these dogs, I just say, don't ever let anybody you don't know pet this dog when you're on a walk. Just don't take the chance, no matter how friendly the dog looks and how relaxed the person is. But if they say, when somebody comes up, I can't let you pet my dog because he might bite or I don't know what he'll do, then oftentimes these dogs are sensitive enough, they'll pick up on the owner's emotion. And what does the person do? The person goes, oh, yeah, and they stiff, their voice changes, and they kind of stare at the dog. And we kind of set the dog up to fail. And so what I have people do, and this works really nicely, is I say, have the people say, I'm training with the pet today, so you can't pet him, but you might throw some treats. And most people that want to pet the dog would be just as happy throwing treats to it. Give them a couple biscuits or a couple pieces of meat or whatever. Have the dog sit. Let the people throw the treats. And everybody wins in this situation. Also saves that bozo who, when he comes up and you say, the dog might bite, goes, oh, you wouldn't bite me. Dogs love me. And get in the dog's face. Anyway. So sometimes you have to... Anyway. So the owner's confident. The approaching person's relaxed. It's got a positive association. Everybody wins when you take that approach. So nice way of safe way of handling the situation. Prevention is really, really key. Bring up the topic of socialization during your exam visits. If you have a single person or a couple that doesn't have children, make sure that they're getting this puppy and this kitten out around a variety of people in a relaxed situation, maybe hand-feeding them little treats or have them come over at dinner time. So we have a lot of positive associations early on. We want to habituate the dog to all types of handling. I tell my new puppy owners and kitten owners, go home and play doctor with the pet. I mean, when you go, look at its mouth, look at its, examine its belly, touch its toes, play stethoscope with the dog, look at its ears, whatever I'm going to need to do, you know, throughout the dog's life, or your groomer, or your trainer, whatever, we need right away to start teaching the dog not to be nervous about these. Prevent trauma, so we got to supervise the dog around children so nothing bad happens. Avoid harsh corrections. A lot of people use punishment, physical punishment, spank the dog to train. Got to make sure we bring up the topic of punishment and tell people not to use physical punishment during training. Got to build that bond during those early months. And we don't want to push the dog into anxiety-provoking situations. Now, problem we see is the dogs that are afraid to come in our hospitals, and boy, it just really pays off dividends to spend some extra time during the puppy visits and make them really, really pleasant. We use a lot of food. Mainly I use kibble, and most puppies are interested enough in food that I can keep a little canister of puppy food there. And what I'll do is I'll meet the puppy and give it a little just piece of puppy food, and then I'll look in an ear and give it a piece of food, and I'll look in its mouth and give it a piece of food, and do a little derm exam and give it a piece of piece of food and so forth. What happens is my touch starts predicting the puppy's going to get something good. And so right away, the puppy's liking this. Doctor come up and touch it all over. And as a matter of fact, there's a video. Veterinary Medicine now has a digital magazine's digital. It's online. And I've got a video on there now demonstrating that. And so, and then during, when I get ready for the shot, I take about 6 or 8 pieces of kibble and put on the tabletop. While the puppy scrambles for the food, you can give the injection. Most of the time, you don't get a reaction. Now, if you have a puppy, some puppies are nervous enough that they're not going to go for dry kibble. And those dogs, I up the ante. We're going to use Kong liver stuffing or Cheese Whiz or canned cat food or something. You put it in a Kong toy or some toy like that. It's easier to handle. And we can have a nurse hold on to that. And while the puppy's licking away, you can do the exam and do the vaccinations. But I use a lot of food during exams. All right, let's talk about thunderstorms now. Thunderstorms can be a really challenge to treat, and they're unusual phobias. They involve a number of stimuli, and we've got sound and light and vibration, change in ambient light, lightning, and so forth. So there are a lot of stimuli to control and to think about as far as counter conditioning. Also, in Kansas City, we see a lot of phobias, but usually we don't see those until the dogs are adults. I don't see many in dogs under a year of age. Once in a while, but not very often. And so they seem to be an acquired problem. And so the question is, why do these dogs have these problems as they become older adults? And nobody really knows. Now, there's some dogs that have been left out in a storm, maybe in the backyard when the owner was out at dinner or something like that, and they've got a reason to be nervous about storms coming in. But oftentimes that's not the case. They just suddenly gradually get into these. And I think some of them might have organic problems in areas like the thalamus or the amygdala, areas in the brain that kind of filter out environmental stimuli. And they don't do a good job at habituating and they overreact. They don't have good locus coeruleus control and so forth. But one of the reasons I think that is because they don't respond very well to conventional behavior modification. And so with behavior modification in these animals, what you would do is you would have a recording, pick the strongest stimulus, which would be sound. You have a recording. You play it at a level where the dog orients but doesn't become anxious, and then you groom it or give it treats or do play with it or whatever, and then gradually increase the volume. But the success rate of just using that by itself is not nearly as high as when you're working with maybe a specific sounds phobia like gunshot phobia or dogs that are afraid of the blender or the microwave button, a beeper or something like that, and I have those dogs. Or dogs that are afraid of insects. I've had 3 or 4 cases of dogs that have actual major panic attacks when they hear an insect buzzing around their head. But you would evaluate the artificial stimulus, and then sometimes one problem is that sometimes you can't fool a dog. Sometimes you can crank it up as loud as you want, and the dog says, yeah, that's a recording. And then if you got no response, you know, then it's not going to help out. So determine the threshold, desensitization, kind of conditioning, avoid reinforcing fear-related behaviors. Sometimes I'll have people do thunderstorm parties. The owners want to do something, but I don't want them just sitting there cuddling the pet, you know, when it feels anxious. And so what I'll try to do is distract the dog in some kind of play. So if we can catch the dog early in the storm, when it's just starting to tremble a little bit, I'll have the owner jump up and go, thunderstorm party, and run into the kitchen and grab a handful of lunch meat and throw a piece of food and go, party time, and run down the hallway and throw a piece of food. And hopefully, if the dog will be focusing on the owner and the treats and the physical activity, we can do some natural counter conditioning where that storm's coming in gently in the background. Now, if the dog's in a full-blown panic attack, it's not going to help. Pheromones sometimes can be helpful. I found pheromones like DAP to be more helpful with firework noise phobias than I have. Again, with this, it's a lot of things don't work with thunderstorm phobias that work with other types of problems. Oftentimes, medication for the really bad ones becomes really important. Let's talk about medication in general here. For anxiety problems and fear problems. There are a lot of drugs that have been used. These are the ones that are the classes that you're going to be considering for problems that have to do with anxiety or phobia problems. Benzodiazepines, Xanax, Valium are really good drugs. Xanax is an excellent anti-panic drug in people, and it's my drug of choice for thunderstorm problems, as well as a panic associated with separation anxiety. With separation anxiety, sometimes you can get by with an SSRI or a TCA, but oftentimes these dogs are panicking so hard, you also need benzodiazepine on an as-needed basis. So for thunderstorms, Xanax is my drug of choice, given about an hour to an hour and a half before the storm gets there. For the really bad dogs, I'll actually even start the day before and give it 1 to 3 times a day. So I get some circulating in the dog's body and then increase it to effect when the storm rolls through. If the dogs are really bad and notch worse, then I'll also start them on a TCA like clomipramine, or Prozac, fluoxetine, or paroxetine, which is Paxil, right before the season starts, about 3 to 4 weeks before the season. You can't give those drugs on an as-needed basis because it takes 2 to 4 weeks to build up in the system. So you start those early, and I think when some of these dogs are really bad, I can get by with less of benzodiazepine if I got some of the an SSRI or a TCA floating around in there. What about acepromazine? Acepromazine is a pretty decent drug for really mild anxiety problems. The dog's a little anxious in the car or in an airplane. But for major anxiety disorders, like the dog that panics during a storm, the amount needed is going to globally affect the dog and wipe out other behaviors, social behaviors, walking. And so Rover is no longer in the living room anxious during the storm, but Rover's now a rutabaga in the living room. And that's not acceptable, especially if storms come in for 3 or 4 days at a time. So we're running a little bit late here. I'm not going to go through the mode of action. We're going to flip through these slides because I think you're probably familiar with the activity of these, and certainly you can go to a good pharmacology book and look up that information, side effects, and so forth. TCAs, the important part of the tricyclic antidepressants is their effect on the serotonergic system. And different drugs in this class have different effects. Clomipramine has the most serotonergic modulation effect of any of the drugs, more than amitriptyline or imipramine or anything else. So clomipramine, theoretically, would be the best drug out of this class. And if I'm going to choose a TCA, that's typically the drug that I will use.
Bennett!
You know, these working dogs have compulsive disorders, right? They need a job, right? He just needs a job. Okay. All right. So, again, I'm going to skip through this. Clomicalm is a drug that's labeled for separation anxiety in dogs. Amitriptyline, I don't use that much anymore. Elavil, my clinical impression is that clomipramine is more effective. Amitriptyline is a little less expensive, so there are some cases that I might consider that, as well as the fact it's a very antihistaminic drug. So some compulsive disorders that have a really strong pruritic component, amitriptyline might be a good choice in those. I use SSRIs a lot for anxiety problems and aggression problems. They have a nice serotonin modulation, and they have very few side effects compared to the TCAs. And so anxiety disorders, compulsive disorders, aggression, urine marking in cats, anxiety-related house soiling, those are the ones that I think on this is the class I'm going to think about here. Side effects, anorexia, more worry in cats than dogs. I don't see that too much. Nausea, upset stomach, not too common, more common in people. Sedation at higher doses you might see. Paxil has been known to cause constipation in cats. I haven't had that problem with Prozac. And paradoxical agitation can occur with any of the psychoactive drugs. So anytime that you prescribe a psychoactive drug and things aren't getting better and you increase it a little bit and things are getting worse, then switch to another drug in the same class or maybe to a different class. Azapirones, Buspar was a drug that was pretty popular for house soiling in cats maybe about 8 or 10 years ago. Don't use it a lot anymore. You have to give it twice a day for most of these cats, so that's a downside compared to once a day for Prozac or Paxil. But it's an extremely safe drug. It has virtually no side effects or organ toxicity whatsoever. So if I have an anxious older cat that has health problems or might be obesity problems, I'm going to think about using Buspar for those cats. Anapril is a drug that's labeled for cognitive dysfunction. It's also a pretty good anti-anxiety drug. And dogs with confusion, disorientation, and you know what the story with these dogs, that's the drug we're going to use. But it's a drug that's a reasonably good drug for separation anxiety. And if you have a dog that so is showing signs of CDS and is showing signs of separation anxiety, a senior geriatric dog, you might want to think about using Anapril in those dogs. It's more commonly used for separation anxiety in Europe than it is here in the United States. And then the pheromones. DAP is a diffuser, a spray, or a collar. Doesn't work on every dog, unfortunately. Works on about maybe 90%, and of those 90%, to varying degrees. I've seen some dogs that within 7 to 10 days of behavior would just really, really significantly change. Other dogs, it changed 10% or so, and some dogs, it doesn't work at all. Nice thing about it, it's really safe. So it's certainly a consideration for any problem that has anxiety or fear as an underlying part of the problem. So anxiety disorders, separation anxiety, settling a pup into a new environment, the pup that whines in his crate at night, travel anxiety, global anxiety disorders tend to be senior pet problems, social and environmental deprivation problems, fear of people. So any of these anxiety problems, you might consider using DAP. Again, it would be a nice consideration for a first choice if you have an older pet or a pet that has some health problems and you're concerned about giving medication. And same way with feel away, same indications. You know, if you're going to prescribe feel away for a householding problem, make sure that you've got enough history to feel comfortable that it's an anxiety-related problem or a territorial problem. The cat just doesn't like the litter box placement or the litter substrate, then your success rate with this product is going to be real low, and your owner's not going to be real happy about spending the big bucks for this product. So get an idea of what you're dealing with before you suggest this product. Murphy was the dog I saw that was nervous during storms. Worse indoors than outdoors. If they were walking the dog outdoors and a storm rolled in, the dog didn't bother the dog. And the dog was also afraid to go upstairs following a certain thunderstorm. The problem was lightning. The dog was in the foyer area. Lightning struck the house. There was a house fire, people yelling and screaming. And that's why the dog was nervous inside the house when he even heard the wind whistle through there. So this is an example of an acquired problem. This was a real interesting one. I saw this dog about 12 years ago, and this is a young Jack Russell Terrier. And the owner called up and said, "Doc, you got to help me. This dog panics during storms." He says it started as a puppy, and his favorite pastime, he said, in his history form was barking, and his occupation was guarding the home from killer squirrels. he's a Jack Russell Terrier. And so there are a couple things here that kind of stood out. First of all, it started as a puppy. As I mentioned earlier, I don't see young dogs with problems, and I said, "Well, what? Tell me about this thing that started as a puppy." He said, "Oh, yeah, as a puppy, we thought it was kind of cute as a puppy, but now we're going to get tired of it." And I said, "Well, tell me about what he does. Tell me about this panic." He said, "Well, he goes to the window and he barks and growls and jumps like he wants to tear that storm apart." And you know, what do thunderstorm dogs usually do? Well, they come to the owner and they shake and they tremble or they hide someplace. And I said, "Started too early. Dog's not doing typical behavior I would expect." And indeed, this was a case where the owner shaped the behavior. His little puppy was barking at storms. They thought it was great. "Hey, Martha, look what the puppy's doing." And gave him a lot of attention. And he was very well trained, and with Jack Russell well trained, that was great. And so we just had him use a shake hand to interrupt the behavior, since it wasn't fear. You wouldn't want to use this with a fear-related problem. A shake hand to interrupt the behavior, and then we just practiced obedience stays for really tasty treats during the storms, and that took care of the problem here. So this is an example of the fact that it's very important to define terms when you're talking about behavior with owners. And if the owner says, "Oh, the dog's jealous when the baby's around," you have to say, "Exactly what does the dog do?" Or, "The dog doesn't like my uncle when he comes over. What does he do? Does he run off? Does he charge? Does he bark? Does he growl? Does he bite? My dog sprays urine, or my cat sprays urine around the house." Well, what do you mean by spraying? "Well, you know, he squats and urinates all over the place." Well, that, in my mind, that's not spraying. Spraying is when a dog goes up to a vertical object and shoots urine out there. So defining terms can be really important, so you're both on the same page here. Okay. We're right at time here. I'll take like maybe two questions, or if not, I'll take some afterwards. A couple important burning questions anyone would ask? Yes, go ahead. How about treating the in 2 minutes or less? Treating the fearful pet in the veterinary hospital, try your best to prevent it. Be aware of body postures and facial expressions. If I walked into an exam room and that dog is leaning back and its ears are down and it's scanning, and I know it's fearful right away, I break eye contact, I hesitate, I spend more time discussing heartworms and diet with the owner and ignoring the dog to start out with. And then I might toss a piece of food over there. If I feel safe doing this, I'll let the owner put the dog on the counter for me, or maybe muzzle it and put it on the counter for me rather than having an unfamiliar person do that. I'll try to use food. Some of them are shut down so much that they only eat food. For the dogs that are really bad and you've got to get that ear swab, or you've got to do that toenail trim, and it's going to take three people to hold that dog down while it empties its anal sacs and urinates and defecates, don't do it. Sedate the dog. You're much better if you get to the point where you say, I can't get this done without manhandling the dog. If you can safely do it, just get the permission from the owner, take it back, and give it some type of intramuscular injection. It'll immobilize the dog, because if you wrestle that dog down, it's going to be 10 times worse the next time it comes in. All right, thank you very much.